Right, Psalm 139, verse 9. If I take my flight to the frontiers of the morning, or dwell at the limit of the western sea, even there thy hand will meet me, and thy right hand will hold me fast. On four Sunday mornings, starting last week, we are studying together Psalm 139. Obviously, it's a very great psalm, and all the commentators say the same. But as we discovered when we began last week, and last week was largely introductory, a curious fact emerges if you read the commentators on Psalm 139. Is that with one voice they all say what a great psalm it is, and with one voice they say that we're not sure what it's talking about. Well, it's difficult to know how a psalm can be a great psalm if we don't know what it's really about. It is, of course, great literature, and I hope to show later on that great literature can be a great stumbling block in the Bible. That is to say, it can stop us finding out what it really means because we're content with lovely language and beautiful thoughts. Well, at any rate, studying the commentators challenged me to find it out, and I decided that there was this holiday time and we hadn't got some great series on hand that we were hurrying through of Christian doctrine or ethics, that I would take my time on these August and September mornings and take four Sunday mornings in order to teach Psalm 139 to myself and to those who come on Sunday morning. Now, one thing is clear, and I think this is what has made it very precious to many people, this psalm, what has made it very special to many people, is that it is an intensely individual psalm, an intensely personal one. The psalms are very often taken up with God in history, but this is taken up with God and me. I was speaking to a minister only yesterday. He asked me what I was going to preach on. I told him Psalm 139. And he was a very experienced man who is actually retired now, and he told me that he used to read and still does read this psalm to people in hospital just before an operation. Now, if he has found in this psalm the words to speak to encourage someone at a crisis like that, then obviously this psalm is very useful for that kind of situation and has a very personal word to people in times of need. And I think that's one of the reasons that Psalm 139 has been a special psalm to many people. This personal element in the psalm, and if you read it right through afterwards, as I hope you will if you're catching up on it and weren't here last week, you will find that it's all about God and me, and that as God is mentioned in every verse, me and I are mentioned in every verse, and the nearness of one to the other. And that is a marvelous fact, isn't it, of real Christianity. It was in an August schoolboys' camp that I first discovered that. That's why I always pray very specially in August for all the young people who've been away on beach missions and holiday parties, because it's one of the unique opportunities in this country, isn't it, for people to hear, away from the rush of school and the holidays, the simple truths of the Christian gospel, often explained so clearly for the very first time. And to me, it came home that August, many years ago, I shan't tell you how many, this essential nature of the personal character of Christianity. I had known that Christianity was ethical. I think most people in this country know that. I had known that Christianity was historical. I'd learnt the story of the kings of Israel and Judah, how dull at school, and the long and seemingly even duller journeys of Paul in his missionary work. I knew it was historical. I knew it had historical foundations. I knew it was ethical and historical, and I knew it was institutional because I'd been brought up, and I'm very thankful for that, to go to church, and I knew that the church was part of Christianity. But you can know all that as I knew it and many of the other young people who came to that camp those years ago and not realize that as well as all these things, Christianity is personal. And if it is not personal, if it does not lead me to a relationship between God and me, then, of course, the very heart of it is gone. And in the end, the ethical and historical and institutional sides of Christianity will become very empty. in our bishop's monthly letter. There's some very shrewd comments on this matter of personal faith. And one comment that he makes is that today we live in a time peculiar in the 1970s and 80s, I think, when public morality is discussed by everybody. Is there anybody in this country who hasn't got a view on South Africa, for example? But personal morality is regarded as forbidden territory. Don't condemn me for what I do, and I won't condemn you for what you do. That's private. That's very much the ethos of our day, isn't it? You're not to tread on my life and look into my life. It's a matter for me to say what I will do. But apparently when it comes to public morality, I'm prepared to say what I like about everybody else's political and social behavior. Now that to me is one of the most remarkable signs of the days in which we're living. Because of course it is utterly fraudulent. Because there will be no social or public morality if there is no personal morality. The idea that I can have a political and social setup in this country which will be kind and unselfish and won't be violent and materialistic and greedy, the idea that I can have that in society without having it in my own life is, of course, quite absurd. So that personal Christianity is at the very heart, isn't it, of biblical Christianity. And this psalm that we're looking at and studying together is very much about it. Now, last week we spent a great deal of our time in introduction. We looked at the beginning and we looked at the end. We also looked at some of the problems, like those rather violent and vicious words in verse 19 to 22, which we shall come on to in a fortnight's time. Many of the commentators find it very difficult that after the very peaceful language about God and myself, I can suddenly ask God to smite the wicked. What does all that mean? Well, we're not coming on to that this morning, partly because I don't know the answer yet. We'll come on to that, I hope, in a fortnight's time if I can get the work done. Last week, we also looked at the first section on the omniscience of God, the fact that he is all-knowing. And now we look at the omnipresence of God in verse 7 to 12, the fact that God is everywhere in his universe. And I'm going to read these from the New English Bible, which I think is perhaps one of the very best of the modern translations of this particular psalm. The NEB often disappoints, but in this case I think not. Verse 7 then. This is our section, the second section, verses 7 to 12. And we're going to do this in detail this morning. Where can I escape from thy spirit? Where can I flee from thy presence? That's the question. Now the answer. If I climb up to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, again I find thee. If I take my flight to the frontiers of the morning, or dwell at the limit of the western sea, even there thy hand will meet me, and thy right hand will hold me fast. And that can be slightly more confrontational and comforting. It can mean, even there thy hand will seize me. If I say, surely darkness will steal over me, night will close me around, therefore God can't see anything. Darkness is no darkness for thee, and night is luminous as day. To thee both dark and light are one. Now the question that has been facing us last week and this, and comes to a focus in verse 7, is this. Is the psalmist, this believer, wanting to escape from God? Is he trying to get away? And my answer at present is a rather tiresome one. It is, as far as I can see, both yes and no. One has to say, first of all, no, but immediately qualified. No, surely he can't be wanting to get away in this psalm if he can end up with a prayer so thoughtful and so open as verse 23 and 24. Because as we saw last week in verse 23 and 24, he asks God to search him in the very depth of his being. And that can't be a very comfortable thing. So if he's asking that at the end of the psalm, I don't think we can say that he's trying to escape from God. At least we can't say that without a good deal of qualification. And yet I think we have to say, after verses 1 to 6, when we looked at how God knows where he sat down and rose up, he traced his journeys, he knew every word on his tongue before he spoke them, His knowledge of him was discriminating and endless and infinite. I think we have to say that when we know that God can see us like that, it's a natural reaction to cover up. Because we are still fallen creatures, aren't we? And the mark of men, the mark of men and women as fallen in the world, is that they're always trying to hide from God. Do you remember Genesis 3? When God comes into the garden in the cool of the day looking for men, what is man doing now that he's disobeyed the command of God? He's hiding, even if it is a futile hiding behind a tree. So that the Christian understanding of men is not that of the television serial, Searching God in Search of God, that we hear so often. The Christian view of man is not fantasy. It is that man is on the run. That man is not looking for God. That man is looking for a way of escape from God. That man wants to be independent of God. He wants to live in God's world without God. Now that is surely right. As you look back to your days before conversion, before regeneration, you will know that that was you. But as the articles of the prayer book say, the infection of sin doth remain. That is, although we may be regenerate in Christ and the Holy Spirit may have renewed us, yet we find, don't we, that still there's that element in our characters that hasn't yet disappeared and won't do until we die, that again and again pops up unexpectedly and often to our grief. Of wanting to wander from God, to go astray. If it were not so, the reformers would never have set that great general confession at the beginning of morning and evening prayer. You see, that general confession, which you won't normally not meet in an extempore service, that general confession is a testimony to a doctrine, isn't it? To an understanding of man, to an understanding that even the Christian will go astray like a lost sheep apart from the grace of God. So, yes, I think it is true that faced with the real God, faced with the knowledge that God had of him, faced with a God who was constantly interfering, constantly looking at his heart, constantly exposing what he was really like, I think there was a temptation that is echoed in verse 7 in these famous words, "Where can I escape? Where can I flee?" Now let's examine the way in which he thinks of fleeing from God. He does this in three little verses, because this is, of course, a poem, each beginning with the word "if." He seeks to cross what I'm going to call three barriers to try to get into a land where God doesn't reign. The first I've called the death barrier in verse 8. "If I climb up to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol," that is, the place of the departed, "again I find thee." I call that the death barrier, and I'll explain that in a moment. In verse 9, he looks at the distance barrier. He looks to the far western sea, which the Israelite thought of as being the edge of the world, and he feels that if he goes across that barrier, he might escape God, but then is brought face to the face that God's hand will meet him there. And then verse 11, he thinks of the darkness barrier, and I'll explain that in a moment, and he finds that if he crosses that barrier into darkness, still he cannot escape from God, because in God there is no difficulty in seeing through that hidden covering. All these three, then, whether death or distance or darkness, stand for areas of great mystery to the psalmist, areas that are beyond human knowledge, places which are terrifying to visit, the western sea or the darkness or the life of the world to come, and where conceivably God might not be found. So let's look at the three in turn. First of all, after death. Now again, you might say immediately, how can he possibly think that after death he won't meet God? And of course, he doesn't think that God won't be in heaven. But remember, this is poetry. So he puts it in a parallel form. He says, if I go to heaven, thou, well, obviously you're there. But now comes a shock. If I go to Hades, I find you're there too. Now let's stop for a moment. Hades was the land of the dead. it was really a non-existence. Remember that the Israelites had no clear knowledge of life and immortality because Christ had not yet come and risen. And therefore for them, God was the God of the living, and God gave them life here and now in this world. And the next world was always to some extent a very cheerless, dark and meaningless existence, just as it is to the average person in Britain today, something we don't talk about and something we don't look forward to. Even the Israelite who knew about the living God felt that if he died, he might be cut off from the land of the living and from God himself. It was a wretched experience, but it was the common fate of all. Now, in this, the Israelite was, of course, influenced by his surroundings, and you remember, if you did classical mythology at school, that Hades is simply the name of the god of the underworld to the Greeks, which is why in, and we won't bother to turn to it now, in Revelation chapter 20, verse 13, we're told that when Christ comes to judge the world, death and Hades are cast into the lake of fire. It's a very vivid statement that any powers of the underworld will be dismissed from the presence of God on the last day. But the terrors of death and existence beyond death can't finally be dismissed until we know that Christ has risen. And, of course, the Christ who rose was the Christ who, after his death, as we say in the Creed, descended into Hades. That is to say, he went into that world, and his triumph was proclaimed in it. But until that great day of the resurrection, Hades was a place, surely, which did not enjoy the sunshine of God's presence. And I want to show you that quite emphatically in two places in the Psalms. First of all, Psalm chapter 6, verse 5. If you look at these very quickly with me, we won't waste time on them, but they help to make the point that I want to make. Psalm 6, verse 5. None talk of thee among the dead. Who praises thee in Sheol? In other words, please keep me alive. I want to praise you. And no one talks about you in the next world, and no one praises you in Sheol. See, that's a pretty dismal outlook, isn't it? Psalm 88, verse 4. I am numbered with those who go down to the abyss and have become like a man beyond help. Like a man who lies dead. That's a man who's beyond help. He's dead. When thou rememberest me no more, because we are cut off from your care. Verse 13. 14. Why hast thou cast me off, O Lord? Why dost thou hide thy face from me? You see, he's talking about this desperate business of being away from God. And look at verse 10. Dost thou work wonders for the dead? Shall thy company rise up and praise thee? Will they speak of thy faithful love in the grave? Will thy wonders be known in the dark, thy victories in the land of oblivion? Now that is how he was brought up. That's what he thought. He believed that God wasn't there in Hades. And therefore, when the psalmist says this remarkable statement in verse 8, he is saying something we ought to have six exclamations after it. He's saying, I go to heaven, of course you're there, and then I try to escape into the underworld, and astonishingly, you're there. Now, there are some scholars that I've discovered who immediately pick on this as a contradiction. I don't know if you meet those kind of people. Directly they find something like this in the Bible, they immediately say it's a contradiction. Some people seem to delight in finding them. At least they do when they meet clergy. I don't know if they do when they meet you. I'm always being shown them by people. So it kind of disproved the Bible. What it usually shows is people's ignorance of the Bible. Because, of course, there's no contradiction here. We have exactly the same tension in the New Testament teaching about hell. We surely are taught to tell people in the name of Christ that if they are determined to live without God in this world, they will live without God in the next world. If they go on saying to God, to Jesus Christ, depart from me, it is no surprise if Jesus on the judgment day says to them, depart from me. So we are constantly, surely, called upon to preach from Christian pulpits that if we reject God and want to be independent of Him now, we shall be independent of Him then. Now, in teaching that, of course, we need to balance it by saying that though it is true that hell is a place where God leaves us to ourselves, there is another side of that truth which tells us that God is everywhere in His universe, and therefore we cannot say that God is absent from hell. Now, surely this is really the terror of hell. Listen to a fellow called Lovell Cox. I think this is a very good quotation. He's talking about these early days when they discovered from God that He ruled everywhere. But it's very contemporary. Once the God of religion had extended His rule over the dim lands beyond the grave, belief in an afterlife, so far from mitigating the dread prospect of death, intensifies its terror. Sheol is transformed into Gehenna. Epicurus, who was a Greek teacher, with more insight than some of his modern disciples, saw that what man fears is not that death is annihilation, but that it is not. That the horror of death is not extinction, but the wrath to come. But of course. That's why people like Bertrand Russell were so constantly saying that when they died, they would rot and nothing of their ego would remain. Of course they had to believe that. Because if your ego did remain, what would it meet? It would meet God. The reason why people like Bertrand Russell believed that death was the end was that the alternative was too awful. If it was not the end, then what? For those who'd rejected God all their lives. Now you see what the psalmist is saying is something that is very relevant to us. There is a sense in which the life of the world to come for the God rejecter is a lonely place. C.S. Lewis has made that plain in his little book, The Great Divorce. But there is a sense in which we must not banish God even from hell. The awful thing about hell is that the Christ rejecter will know that Christ is Lord and will have to meet his judge and face him in that day. So that what the psalmist is saying is very relevant to today. There is no way beyond death that I can escape him. Now, of course, the Christian knows that, and the Christian, thank God, doesn't want to escape him, but there are many people today who seek the exit of death in order to escape. They may not put it quite in those terms that they want to escape God, but they want to escape everything. And in our day, when suicide, especially, for example, amongst teenagers, is rising at a quite horrendous rate, we need, therefore, to teach this. Also, with regard to drugs, down in the schools in Bethnal Green, drugs are coming in force, and therefore we should be concerned about it. Drugs are, of course, one of today's escape mechanisms. Glue sniffing, for example, which is so terrifyingly prevalent at the moment. And as you will know, if you read a local paper, hardly a week goes by when some youngster does not die, not through immediately wanting to, but through tragically sniffing too much and getting affixed in it. Now, what this psalm is telling us is that God, our Creator, gave us life and will require of us an answer of how we live it. And we do not slip into oblivion at death. He is there. And surely we ought not to keep these things from children. The sooner we can leave behind the sort of fantasy teaching that many children get about God and the Bible, the better. I read last week of a boy of 9 who got an A in O levels in maths. Did you read it? A very brilliant child. Thinks he's going to be a genius, apparently. Well, if you can get O levels in math at the age of 9, you ought to know about God. There's nothing you ought to be withheld from. You ought to. I remember as a curate going to an isolation hospital near Sevenoaks. The sister met me and she said, "Oh dear, I'm so glad you've come today and not the rector." I was the curate. She said, he was speaking to the children last week about death. Well, why not? Why not? It was a very dreadful thing. She was glad to see the curate. It's always nice to be wanted, isn't it? But I'm not sure that's the right reason. See, This is what we need to teach, not just to old people, but to young people. We need to tell them that if I make my bed in Hades, I find him. And nine is not too old to be asked why I behaved as I have done. That's the first if. Now let's look at the second if in verse 9. This is a case where the beauty of the English can hinder our understanding. The English here is particularly beautiful, isn't it? If I take the Wings of the Morning, which is one of the inspired translations of the Bible, isn't it? And dwell in the outermost parts of the sea, you see, but it means nothing, just like that. What he is saying is this. The morning stands for the east. The outermost parts of the sea stands, of course, for a Jew, for the west, because the only sea he knows is the Mediterranean. And he's frightened of it. He's not a sea-going people. And he thinks that at the far end of the Mediterranean Sea, you'll fall off. That's the edge of the world. So you see, he thinks of the utmost distance, where the sun rises and where the sun falls. His world is a very small one. And he says, supposing I went to the very limit, supposing I tried to escape from this God-blessed country of Israel, would I get away from you? No, I wouldn't. When I got there, when I went with the speed of light to the limit of the world, your hand would seize me and hold me fast. Now that is much more striking to him than it is to you, because to the man of Israel, he saw his God very much as the God of Israel, and all around him were people who believed in gods, but they were always local gods, and they had their territory, and they handed other territory over to other people, rather like a robin, you know, looking for its territory and handing over other territory to others. The birds do it, and apparently in the old days they thought the gods did it. But you see, in the Bible, we suddenly find that the real God doesn't do that. And that the real God is there, everywhere, and we cannot escape him. Now, this idea of traveling to escape is not uncommon. I was speaking to a Christian man 3 weeks ago, and talking about his family, and he said, I suppose you know, don't you, that my older daughter's left home and we don't know where she is. Now that's a very tragic statement, isn't it? And obviously, they're a very sad family. Not to know where one of your daughters is must be an awful thing. And for some reason that girl has wanted to escape, to be independent of authority, to go her own way. And what the psalmist is saying there is, if in some way I should try to do this with God, I cannot escape him. Now that's a very remarkable knowledge, isn't it, before the New Testament. Not so remarkable now, because we know that Christ is a universal Lord, and that wherever we go we shall find him. And that comes out again and again, doesn't it? I think of a boy called Chris. He won't mind my saying this now, if he should ever hear this on a tape, a very proud, rich young ruler in the city. He was cynical and disillusioned. He was doing very well. He came to see me one day and told me that he didn't want to have anything to do with his parents. He dropped his family name and called himself by a new surname, and he was going off to seek his fortune in the world. And I sought to tell him about Christ, but he wouldn't listen. Well, you can imagine my amazement when a year or so later he dropped into the vestry, a thorough Christian. He'd been to South Africa, as it happened, and in Johannesburg, quite by chance, he'd gone into a basement, I think thinking it was some kind of pop club, and he'd found that the noise came from a Christian gospel group. And he'd heard the gospel, God had turned him right upside down, or rather the right way up. And he came back a new man, he's in the ministry today preaching the gospel. Now that's the meaning, isn't it, of verse 10. Doesn't matter where I fly to, doesn't matter where I dwell, your hand will seize me, hold me. There's the second barrier. Now the third if. The third if is in verse 11. This is the darkness barrier, and it's not just children that fear it. I think we don't quite see this picture today, because by just the touch of a finger we can put the light on, can't we? But sometimes in our lives we do face what a terror darkness really is if it can't be. if it can't just be switched off. And so in the Bible, darkness is always a mysterious area where Satan reigns, so that Satan is the god of this world and the god of the powers of darkness. And that is why, I suppose, men do sin and evil more easily at night than in daytime when people can't see them. Just imagine where you might get to if nobody could see you and you were in darkness all the time. I suspect that your life would not be the same life as it is lived in daylight. So you see, I want to go into darkness, he says. I want to go into that area where evil reigns. Surely God won't be there. If I plunge into that, that's going to be a country where God will not come. That's a very, very popular viewpoint, isn't it? I'll go off with this set of friends. I'll do that set of things. And God will not be there. Not amongst those people. Not in Satan's kingdom. Darkness is no darkness to him. He sees it all. Now, all these three examples are really saying the same thing. This is poetry, but he's enlarging on it. He's thinking of those realms where the other powers are thought to be. Evil powers, realms where God might not dwell, realms that God might very well hand over to themselves, hand over to evil and death and sin. And he contemplates what it must mean to try to fly there. And to do so, of course, only shows how sick our hearts can be. But we saw last week that they can be like that. And he realizes as he meditates on these things that it's impossible. Because in these lands, which we might very well hand over to evil, wash our hands of, God has not washed his hands. He's in control. And look at the language of God's control. In verse 8, he is there. His presence is there. In verse 10, his hand is active. That is, he acts. His hand, his arm, always speak of his actions. And in verse 11, 12, he sees. Now, will you forgive a very earthy and city illustration? Just imagine that, think of Harrods for a moment. I don't know if you've been to Harrods. It's an amazing world, isn't it? And supposing I, personally, can go to Harrods whenever I want. For example, you're having supper with me, and at about 9 o'clock I say, well, let's get in the car and go down to Harrods. I'd like to show you around. And then as we go around Harrods, in every department, people have rushed back from work to be there, and I can lay my hands on everything. And I say, we'll change that, we'll get rid of that, and I'll have that. And you get more and more amazed at who I am. And then you find that I'm able to call for all the private papers of the chairman, all the unpublished accounts that don't come out for the stock exchange to see, and all the secrets of management. All the papers are put into my hands as I come into the building so that I know all the secrets of how Harrods is run. What does that mean? What does it mean if it was really true? Well, of course, that's the language of takeover, isn't it? Which you read about in the paper almost every day. That's the language of control. If a man may be present in Harrods and do anything with any part of it that he wants, and he's able to see in all the secrets of management so nothing is hidden from him as to what goes on there, then he's in control of it. That's what it means to take over. See, so what the psalmist is using here, though it is actually the language of poetry, is the language of divine control. Beyond death, God is there. At the frontiers of the morning, God is active. Through the darkness, God knows everything. Now, what shall we say about this? Well, just a few things as I close this morning. First, it is surely a very great interest that the psalmist tells God all this. You see, the psalmist is not primarily speaking to us, to you. He is not speaking really to God, is he, in a sense that he's teaching God anything, though he is speaking to God, but he's speaking to God for his own enlightenment, not God's. That is, he is rehearsing these things before God. Now, that is one of the essential elements of worship. That's why it's in the Psalter, and we do exactly the same in the psalm, in the hymns, in church. We come to church, and I don't know if you've noticed sometimes how quaint it is, we sing things that God knows perfectly well already, and we tell him these things. as he's doing in the psalm. Now, is that a waste of time? No, he's coming, you see, he's rehearsing these things in the presence of God, and he's doing it not in order to tell God, but in order to come to terms with this reality himself. See, I said last week that this psalm is full of theology, but theology actually doesn't help you in times of temptation and trial. You see, you know that God is omnipresent. You know that God is everywhere. You know that theological doctrinal truth. That was something I've known from the first days that I studied the Bible. But when I get into a position of temptation or trial or sorrow, that doesn't help me at all. To know that fact. I only find help if I meditate on it and come to terms with it. And that takes time to do, which is what the psalmist is doing. That's why we meet on Sunday morning. This is why we have daily times of quiet if we possibly can. They are lifelines to reality, aren't they? As he meditates, you see, he comes to terms with reality. If I take my flight today, if I were to drop everything and to leave my family, my husband, my children, I just can't stand it any longer, and I was just to go and leave it all behind, there you are. Well, it makes a difference, doesn't it? Now, let me explain why this is so important. I and me are at the center of our world. We live, don't we, in that kind of existentialist world today. It's partly due to the fall, of course, but it's also our own times. That is to say, we all live in a me world. Me is at the center of everything. And because that is so, whether we turn on the telly or go to work or read a novel or whatever it may be, I can ultimately think that this is reality, that what will satisfy me, what will make me healthy and wealthy and wise, is the ultimate deal. I will come to think that being the fully developed person is the only thing that matters, and here I am, chained to the kitchen sinks with 14 children, and I cannot find my femininity and my individuality. I cannot develop myself as I like if I remain like that, you see. And the whole purpose of life is that I should find myself. That's very much today's philosophy, isn't it? And therefore, you see, religion, these people talk about, is just a crutch. But I don't need it because I'm finding myself. Now, we're going to be very influenced by that. And so I need constantly, once a week to the very minimum, to meditate upon God. Not an abstract, cold, theological truth. I need to think about him. I need to say, where can I escape from you? If I say, surely darkness will steal over me, well, darkness is no darkness to you. I need to say that. I need to meditate on it. It's not enough to know it. I've got to think it through. It's got to become part of my bloodstream. Yesterday I was coming along the motorway and falling asleep, and as you know, it's a dangerous thing to do on the motorway, because I went into one of those motorway places. Nothing would persuade me to do that on a bank holiday weekend except that I was falling asleep. And, of course, the place was an inferno. So I simply bought a new magazine I saw on business in the city and went into the car and slept and read it. And I read that the chairman of one of the great clearing banks, quite close to here, leaves the city. You may like to know this little bit of tidbit. He leaves the city promptly on Friday in order to sail throughout the weekend. Now, bless his heart, he must need to escape, mustn't he? He's the chairman of a clearing bank. Everybody needs to escape. But you see, that escapism of his is one that nobody can afford. Because it means that never on Sunday does he hear the word of God or listen to the word about Jesus Christ. That means he will increasingly live into a fantasy world. And indeed, the article was a fantasy article about how this great clearing bank is going to defeat the Big Bang, as though that was the only thing that really mattered. There was also an article about Willie Purves, the new head of Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank. You may have shares in it, so you may like to know that Willie Purves is an alcoholic. Not an alcoholic, a workaholic. I'm so sorry. I shall be head up for libel, shan't I? A workaholic. He's a very brilliant banker, so he's not likely to be an alcoholic. He's a workaholic. And there are many good stories about him, and one of the best is this. His wife rang up and said, "Hello, I just wondered whether you were coming home to dinner tonight." "Well," he said, "it's only 6:30. "Yes," she said, "but it is Sunday." Now, That's what Sunday is for, you see, that I may just say these things. If I take my flight to the frontiers of the morning, there you are. Even if in the daytime you're too busy to have a quiet time, I hope that isn't so, but for some of you with young children, I know it's sometimes almost impossible to find time to pray. Well, then let me tell you that just as the businessman snatches a sandwich, you must snatch the Psalms. Just paste it up on your window where you work. Put it on a board near you. Say and read it through. Underline it. Just take time to take it in. See, and as you do that, you will come to recognize, as I have come to recognize studying this all during this week, that it is completely different, this, from all that religion ever taught us. Religion teaches us, do this, do that, do the other, and you may one day find the presence of God. That's characteristic of religion, to tell us what we must do if we're to find God's presence. Christianity says, do what you like, but you can't escape his presence. That's the fundamental, the place you've got to start. What, as the Puritans used to say, are the uses of this for us today, then, the applications? Well, there's one very striking one, and there isn't time to go into it now, but I'll give you this as a cross-reference. It was read to us by Jane a little earlier on. For my last cross-reference, turn over to Jeremiah chapter 23. And it is a striking one. We've just thought of the chairman of the Clearing Bank and the head of the Hong Kong Bank. They never have time to think about God, never. And therefore they will one day find themselves to have lived in a fantasy world when they find that you cannot escape him. But that's a fairly familiar thing, that materialism is driving a people away from thinking about God. But you see, the Bible tells us something much more horrifying, that religion can also be an escape hatch, a rabbit hole. Jeremiah 23, it's all about these false prophets. And it tells us about them in chapter 23 and verse 14. It tells us that, if you just glance at it, verse 14, that they didn't change anybody's lives. Well, that's typical of the church in the first 50 years of the century, isn't it? And indeed still is in many ways, that comfortable church going never turns anybody back from sin. Verse 16, we're told that their message is one that is full of wishful thinking, imagination, and false hopes. It's always optimistic. Verse 17, they offer prosperity. That's their message. Characteristically, that's their message. But notice what he says about them, that they have not stood in his counsel, verse 22. And he says, can a man hide in any secret place and I not see it? Do I not fill heaven and earth? Here you see are the prophets who have got away from God. They have, in a way, hidden from God. And so their message is fundamentally divorced from the reality of God. That is to say, these false prophets didn't speak about spiritual and moral reality. To listen to them, as to listen to some people today, is simply to go into a dream world, to wander into cloud cuckoo land, and that's terribly dangerous. If you're unregenerate, of course, to go to a church which takes you into cloud cuckoo land is terrifying, isn't it? To wake up after death to find that you never knew about God and forgiveness, heaven or hell. But for the regenerate person, it can be painful, too, to go to a church where they live in a fantasy world, constantly talking about prosperity and other things and never bring us face to face with sin and repentance. But you can't escape God, and if you're a Christian, he won't let you escape him. So we come back. If I take my flight to fantasy religion, even there thy hand will seize me, and thy right hand will hold me fast. God won't let you go, either into materialism or fantasy religion. He'll bring you back to reality if you're his. Let's pray. Our gracious God, we pray that from this inadequate study of Psalm 139, as we continue it, you will teach us all about your greatness. We thank you that there is no realm in the universe where you are not, where your hand does not rule, where you do not see. And that makes us tremble as we try to fly. But it also makes us confident that there is no limit to your ability to recapture those who have strayed. So continue to teach us as we worship you and meet together this morning, for Christ's sake. Amen.